Susan Smalley?
Yeah, I'm interested in this idea that broadcasting has changed. One of the things that happens in the 30s is when broadcasting is first introduced, is you move from this idea of what if you wanted to hear someone, you went in a big crowd in the public. So I think the people in the 30s felt very much that they were listening in private, that this was a private message to them. People wrote to Roosevelt all the time, you came to me in my home just for me, I feel like you're talking just to me. So the difference was great to them, and they saw it as a very private message coming out of the radio. I take the point that they were people listened in groups, and they sometimes did, and that whole neighborhoods and people shared things. And I agree that things have changed now, and we've made another step toward listening singly. But it's no bigger a step than the one that was from no radio to radio. And now we've gone from radio to television, which was private in one way, and then another step into new media or listening to the radio through earphones.
You make a great point. It's fascinating. So in a way, people's homes now are in their own head. People are now, which is a very isolating, solitary experience, and gosh, an original thought here is coming to my head. I mean, this is that the evolution of media has been just an evolution of private listening, and the living room was a very private place for families and friends. I guess walking down the street or going to Ebbets Field was a private experience too, or Yankee Stadium.
I think all of these experiences are both public and private at the same time. And so as one thing gets privatized, then there's other ways to be public. And my guess now is that we're interacting with media in a much more private way, and we're using it to social network, to make connections, to move out into the public in a different way. And that happens each time something gets more private. There's other ways to connect to the public. The ways that what public and private means just changes a bit.
Well, let's take for instance his involvement then in politics quite strictly. That Coughlin basically began to evolve from sort of discussing the matters of the heart and God and Jesus into a sort of a political perspective about those people who had the money, those people who didn't have money. But then, and quite importantly, in relating to this discussion about the connection between private and public, he began to support Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and in fact supported him and the New Deal all the way into the mid-30s until there was a point where he broke with Roosevelt. Isn't that true?
Yes. He certainly could see Roosevelt whenever he wanted to. Roosevelt was aware of Coughlin's audience, the size of it, although I was always struck by something Mrs. Roosevelt said. My husband never trusted him, and I would say that was true, too. But frankly, my impression was that Coughlin wanted to be president of the United States. But since he was born in Hamilton, Canada, that was out of the question. So he actually handpicked a congressman from North Dakota, starts a political party, a la the Tea Party, called the National Union for Social Justice, and thinks he can translate his listening audience into votes. He did not realize, and I think one vast difference between then and now, is that many of the people who listened to Coughlin also revered Franklin Roosevelt. I don't think that's the case today in terms of listening to people on the far right today having that feeling towards our present president. Coughlin, I think, grew frustrated that Roosevelt certainly found time to see him, but he came to realize influence, no.
But there are broadcasters today who revere Barack Obama, just as there were broadcasters who revered George Bush. I'm always amused that people say, isn't this just scandalous that so-and-so, you know, talks politics and religion? Or isn't it so scandalous that so-and-so on the radio or on television, talks politics in this way? Well, that's been relatively common all the way along. I would just take some issue with Michael's point that there are awful books written, books you don't agree with written. Broadcasting, as it was up until quite recently, and books are very different because the airwaves are supposed to be public. And what's interesting now is that no one, for years on American broadcasting, it was a huge issue that you had to present both sides. And now we have MSNBC, MSNBC, we have Fox News. Neither one presents the other side except to make fun of it. And no one seems to, that seems to me to be a huge change in American broadcasting.
Although that's how American journalism was originally.
Right. But print journalism.
Print journalism.
Could you expand on that, Eve?
Well, back in the day when each city had multiple newspapers, there was the Democratic paper and the Republican paper and the Socialist paper and so forth, and no journalist was under any sort of obligation to be objective. Each paper had its own unabashed political viewpoint, and it was only when during the sad decline of print journalism that papers had to start to be more objective because they were often the only print journalist voice in town.
I'd like to know if Michael thinks that the rise of these partisan broadcasters comes about with cable television and cable radio and many greater number of broadcast outlets.
The rise of cable, the rise of the internet.
Fair enough.
Cable is old hat compared to the internet. This is the key to the whole discussion, what Susan has brought up, and we don't disagree that much, because in those days, the idea of the public airwaves was a very powerful thing, and it was the responsibility of the government which administered this to make sure that it was as fair and as open and as balanced as possible, and that it was also regulated on other levels because it came into your home and your children were listening, and it was truly mass media. You got to remember, Coughlin reportedly had something like a 33% share of the American public listening to him. Rush Limbaugh, at his biggest, only has 5% of the radio audience at that time. We're talking about it's a much smaller segment of the audience.
And yet, in the even though Rush Limbaugh is grandest, has 5% of the radio listeners, the combination of all the broadcasters who are conservative is probably much higher than that. And I'd like
let me answer that.
Go ahead.
The combination of all the broadcasters that are conservative is higher than that, but you're making the mistake of thinking that all talk radio and all radio is conservative. There are liberals, there are moderates, there are conservatives, there's National Public Radio, there's Public Radio International, there's Pacifica, there are shock jocks on FM talking public policy, talking issues, there's urban talk radio with black talk show hosts, very, very sympathetic to the Democratic Party. And when you step back and you look at the whole pie statistically, as opposed to twisting the statistics for your own political agenda, whether it be the left or the right, you say, wait a second, the marketplace is balanced. And that is not discussed.
Let me bring up here a friend of mine, Jim Corwin, who's the general manager of four Clear Channel stations. Clear Channel was one of the largest holders of AM radio stations in the country, to discuss exactly why and who he put on the air. I think it would give us a sense of that. Jim?
Well, pre-Clear Channel, we had the ability to hire local talk show hosts, and that clearly is the best model for talk radio. When Clear Channel decided they wanted their talk show hosts to be syndicated across the country, it made it much more difficult to run a talk radio station from a financial standpoint. So I can really only speak from a financial standpoint. Certainly, Rush Limbaugh's ratings are Rush and Glenn have some of the highest ratings. But when I was selling local talk radio and selling Arlene Violet and Buddy Cianci and Steve Cass and Sherm Strickhauser, we were a much more successful radio station financially.
Why did you choose to go towards left-wing radio at some point and then go back to more conservative radio?
Because all of my conservative talk show hosts were lured to bigger markets. And I didn't have any. I mean, I took a stab with Arlene Violet, who was a moderate, and with Air America. And I think the downfall of Air America, for the most part, was that their talent was just not up to it. Al Franken was not a good talk show host.
And yet, in our conversations, you talked about what your sponsors wanted.
Well, sponsors did not want liberal talk radio when we had Air America, but again, that could be the talent. I will say that the business community tends to be, I believe, a little bit more conservative, and we were far more successful selling talk show hosts who had a conservative bent than those who had a liberal bent.
You're listening to Action Speaks. We're talking about today Father Coughlin, the great radio host of the 1920s and 30s, a man who really opened up the airwaves to church and politically based radio, and in some ways is the forerunner of many of today's talk show hosts. We're with Sheldon Marcus, Evelyn Stern, Michael Harrison, Susan Smullyan, and I'm Mark Levitt. We're here at AS 220. Sheldon Marcus, there was a lot of things that Father Coughlin did in some ways that presaged sort of the interfacing of various media and bringing people together. After 1936, when Roosevelt won definitively, he sort of began a number of more... Like he developed a newspaper and he developed a political group. And then later, supposedly, a group called the Christian Front.
He started a weekly newspaper called Social Justice. And he told me that I like the printed word better than the spoken word because the printed word can remain in the house for weeks. The spoken word disappears into the air. That's what he told me. I think he was also having trouble putting together a large enough series of different networks to reach a large enough audience, because I think it was clear to him that he had been rejected by the people who voted for Roosevelt. So he has his weekly newspaper. He has his rallies. He did not step back, and he takes a more extreme position, by the way. As the years go on, he becomes more and more vitriolic. And what really silenced, yes, Roosevelt brought in Leo Crowley, and there was a new archbishop in Detroit who couldn't stand Coughlin. And I think something that may not be clear today is that you have to understand in the 30s, Catholicism viewed communism as a competing religion. It had its Bible called the Communist Manifesto. It had its saints, Marx, Lenin, and the Catholic Church was very frightened by what they saw going on in Europe. It's why they, I think, viewed fascism as less threatening than communism. But Coughlin was actually silenced with the dropping of the first bombs on Pearl Harbor. Then his audience left him in toto.
Eve Stern?
I think that's a really important point, that at its core, it's that they are were competing for the same constituency. They were competing for the working class. And let's do more for the working class before they flee to the Socialist Party, before they flee to the Communist Party.
So Father Coughlin starts to fall, but before we sort of take him and watch what happens to him as the time goes on, I think the elephant in the room was Father Coughlin. Many say that he was anti-Semitic and a Nazi. True or not true?
I wouldn't say he was a Nazi, but I would say he was anti-Semitic for sure.
Why?
We just listen to his radio broadcasts from the mid-30s on and read. I mean, his Social Justice was publishing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, it...
Could you explain what that is?
Well, that was basically a conspiracy theory document presenting this crazy idea that there was this international Jewish conspiracy to essentially... control the world economy, am I getting this right?
Take over the world, mm-hmm. But luckily for the non-Jewish world, the plotters left a copy of the document when they left the meeting in Basel, Switzerland, where this allegedly took place, and lo and behold, because we now had this copy and the Tsar's secret police found it, the Christian world could be saved from the Jews.
Which is great, because they couldn't have been so smart if they left it there.
By the way, I kid you not.
Was there a current of anti-Semitism in the United States at that time?
Absolutely. I mean, that was running through the Great Depression from the beginning. You know, there was, everyone was looking for a scapegoat for the Depression. It was easy to blame Jews, right? There had always been a strong current of anti-Semitism in American politics, American society, and Americans associated Jews with Wall Street. They blamed Wall Street for the Depression. They were looking for someone to blame. It was an easy connection to make.
And before World War II, hostility among major religions was much stronger than it is in the post-World War II era. World War II, in addition to being a monumental military event, was also a monumental social event, culminating in the women's rights movement, civil rights, and also, I think, many American clergy, Catholic clergy, were horrified by what they saw of the Holocaust after World War II. And I think many of them asked themselves, were we part of this? And I think there was a coming together that did not exist before World War II. Although I must tell you, even at Fordham, I've seen the most wonderful priests, and then I've seen anti-Semitic priests. It's human nature, folks.
So Father Coughlin did take some of that tendency.
He was a product of his time.
Even as a product of his time, he was more anti-Semitic than most. I don't think more open about it. Maybe so. But when you're more open about it, when you're calling people to join your cause, that's a different thing than harboring racist or bigoted thoughts. It's really different to go on the radio or to print in your magazine the protocols of the Elders of Zion. That's a different thing.
We have a question from the audience. Could you tell us your name and where you're from?
Okay. I'm Robert Goff from Providence. I just want to bring it back to the present again. I have a question for Michael Harrison. Kathleen Hall Jameson, who's quite a famous media critic, has a book called The Echo Chamber, where she talks about how Rush Limbaugh, Rupert Murdoch's Fox, and Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal are all connected up, with a similar audience that have a much wider effect than you're suggesting in this, magical media landscape where pluralistic media have all shapes of opinion. Yeah.
What does it matter? What's the point? It might be larger than I suggested. It might be smaller than I suggested. Is that against the law? Again, it goes back to the premise that somehow, if people like the Fox News Channel, they like Glenn Beck, or they like Rush Limbaugh, they're part of this destructive, anti-Semitic, propagandistic policy. Somebody mentioned before Al Franken wasn't a very good talk show host. Maybe he wasn't a very good talk show host by certain standards, but here he was, a failed comedian. His biggest claim to fame was he wrote a book against Rush Limbaugh. He hadn't been on Saturday Night Live for a long time, and he became a talk show host espousing liberal progressive policies and parlayed the following and the attention he got from this in a medium that seems to have a reputation for not being fertile for liberals, and he's now a member of the United States Senate. Now, do you think that Al Franken would have made it to the Senate had he not been a talk show host for 2 years? No way. And he did that as a liberal. So back to your comment, sir. The echo chamber concept. What happens is Imus says something on his program that he thinks is among his private little niche audience that love Imus, and nobody complains. The next day, all those public policy groups out, all those special interest groups out that are monitoring everything being said, they blast it out on the internet. It makes it to the networks. It's played over and over and over and over in every medium, and suddenly everybody hears it, an echo effect.
Well, I'm curious, Michael. There has been occasion, you mentioned the one with Imus, when he made what was purportedly quite racist remarks about members of the Rutgers University women's basketball team. There's been situations where that Mr. Sanchez questioned the whether or not the Jewish people, again, were manipulating the media. There's also been aspects of Michael Savage's work that have been extremely anti-homosexual. And many of those people have really suffered vocationally, and many of them were at least thought to be kicked off the radio as a possibility. None really did of all those three. Is there any line that you would draw?
Oh, I think that we're all responsible for what we say on the airwaves or not. I don't buy into the public airwaves anymore because I'm living in the 21st century and I'm talking about the future. I balance that with a belief that we are all responsible for whatever we say and we should face the consequences of those statements.
But would you agree with the owners of a station taking someone off the air because of things
yes,
they say?
Yes, that's their right, because the First Amendment protects the owners of the station, not the talent they hire. And this is a mistake about the First Amendment people make all the time. What do you mean you won't let me have my call? Or you won't print my letter to the editor? What about my First Amendment rights? First Amendment only protects the person who owns the paper. Start your own paper. Buy your own radio station.
Sue Smullen, what do you think of that?
I'm interested in the idea that that all media are equal and that anyone can go start a radio station or could go start a newspaper. You know, that just doesn't seem possible to me. I understand you can make a podcast, but without the backing of Clear Channel or of Fox Radio or any of the television stations, you don't have the same audience. So some people get bigger audiences than other people, and it's not just because their ideas are better. It's because they, for whatever reasons, agree or get chosen by the people who own the media. It's not, I think free marketplace just is too simple a concept for what we have. I take it that it's diverse, but I also take it that some people have more power than other people.
I'd like to ask one more question before we start bringing to an end. I was listening to Father Coughlin, and I've been listening to speakers from the 30s, and I listened to Glenn Beck and even Rush Limbaugh, and there's a way in which they speak that is much more modern in its ironic tone. In other words, as they speak, they sort of know people are also skeptical about it, and yet at the same time, people are willing to buy into it as part of almost a performance art. Michael, do you notice a difference in delivery?
This is where I live. It's show business. It's all show business. They wear makeup for presidential debates. Ross Perot, I can't believe I'm sitting here. They're all putting makeup on. Are we running for president or are we actors? Politics is a spectator sport. There's nothing new about it. And that's what they all have in common.
I believe that there are... that people have political convictions, and that that some of it, I don't disagree that this is entertainment, but I do think that these aren't empty shows, either now or in the 30s, that there is content. People are talking about the issues of the day, but I would never say that what they're saying is similar. They're very different.
Let's take one more question from the audience. Your name and where you're from?
My name is Ned Connors. I'm from Providence. There's more to this than showmanship, because one of the things Father Coughlin demonstrated was that there's a very direct link between this kind of, you know, messianic radio showmanship and direct political action, especially with the forming of the Christian Front, which was in a way sort of a template for the extreme right wing and even Islamic fundamentalist movements, this whole idea of working in these anonymous cells. You know, and there have been very serious studies where, in social justice, he was taking Goebbels, Deutsche Overseas News Bureau news reports, and reproducing them word for word in social justice. This is not showmanship.
Let's have a 1-minute wrap-up for everybody. 1 minute. Let's start with Sheldon Marcus.
Well, the discussion has been very broad-ranging, but in terms of Father Coughlin, many of you will be around when some of the documents that is now currently unavailable will be made available. One of the issues that I could not resolve was, the gentleman was very accurate in what he said, word for word reprinting of German Nazi press releases coming right out of Goebbels' office. The FBI followed Coughlin around all the time. And I can tell you that the Freedom of Information Act tells us that Coughlin enjoyed a very healthy sex life because the FBI agents would wire it back to J. Edgar Hoover, who, of course, kept terrific records like this on many people because that was a source of power.
I can't believe what's happening now. J. Edgar, are you there, J. Edgar?
But whether or not he was actually in the employ of Mussolini and Hitler, that remains to be seen. And the role of the Vatican in all this, I think that's something you can look forward to over the next 20, 30 years of learning about.
Evelyn Stern.
Wow, that's that's a hard act to follow.
He was named publicly in two divorce suits at a third party.
I have nothing equally titillating to leave you with. I, you know, was just going to end with a thought that until, you know, until the mid-30s, when he becomes, you know, increasingly problematic, bitter, anti-Semitic, Nazi sympathizer, I mean, he did play a really interesting role in providing a sympathetic voice and a vague but not entirely non-cogent economic critique for working and lower middle class Americans who were wondering what the heck is going on with the economy and how am I going to protect what I've got. And it's an interesting study in sort of grassroots political mobilization until it went horribly wrong.
Michael Harrison.
A couple of quick points. One, the worst scoundrels in history, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, you know, Obama, whoever you want it to be, they always mix kernels of deep truths in with their propaganda and their evil deeds. So you'll always find, well, I agree with what he said, therefore everything must be right. Not true. Two, you cannot compare the media of 2010 and beyond with the media of 1920 and 1930. Three, and I'm out. The First Amendment is what makes us America. Without the First Amendment, you can wave the flag all you want, you can call yourself an American, you could say what you like, we no longer will be the concept that is America. And the First Amendment is the most difficult thing to defend.
And Susan Smullyan.
When we look at the changes that radio brought to the 1920s and 1930s, and we see now a very different a media landscape that's really changing, that while the changes aren't the same, there are useful comparisons. And I it's not that I disagree about the First Amendment. Of course, I agree. But the question of who has access and who has a way of addressing or using their First Amendment rights seems to me key now as it was then. And so when you talk about how much it costs to go on the radio and what Father Coughlin had to do in order to raise money to be on the radio, I think those issues are the same in many ways today as we think about the new media landscape. Who's going to have access? Who's going to have power? Who's going to say what gets on?
Today we've been discussing the career and the radio descendants of Father Charles Edward Coughlin, a man who changed how radio and indeed media itself was used, as well as its role as a pulpit for the promotion of a political point of view. As we move forward in the Barack Obama administration, and as talk radio continues to be a potent participant in our ideological town square, we wonder what Father Coughlin would think peering down at the cacophonous and at times vicious invectives that color our national debate. Please don't expect me to be the one to answer that question. If there is indeed an up there, I'm sure, well, I'm really not sure that Father Coughlin and I will share the same hangouts, given that I've lived this life being Jewish. Our thanks today to our panelists, Dr. Susan Smullyan, professor in the Department of American Civilization, Brown University, and the author of two books, Selling Radio, The Commercialization of American Broadcasting, and Popular Ideologies, Mass Culture at Mid-Century. Michael Harrison, editor of Talkers magazine. Dr. Sheldon Marcus, a professor in the Division of Educational Leadership and Policy at Fordham University, Graduate School of Education, and the author of Father Coughlin, The Tumultuous Life of the Priest of the Little Flower, and Dr. Evelyn Stern, associate professor at the University of Rhode Island, the director of graduate studies, and the author of Ballots and Bibles, Ethnic Politics and the Catholic Church in Providence. Thanks as well to AS220 and the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, to Johnson & Wales University, and to a donor who prefers to remain anonymous, to our media partners, our presenting radio station, 89.7 WGBH Boston, to Rhode Island Public Television, to the Providence Phoenix, to our producer for today's show, Michael Siegel, audio engineer and editor, Jim Moses, sound engineer, Anthony Ferrara, to house manager, Michael Riley, videographer, Stephen Crocker, photographer Vera Levitt, production manager Zach Drummond, and our own Providence What Cheer Brigade for our introductory music, and to Radio Valium, the new tranquilizer from Brisket Myers, allowing you to listen to talk radio without getting angry. Radio Valium, when it all feels too much, it suddenly isn't. If you'd like to learn more about the subjects we talked about today on Action Speaks, comment about our shows, get links to some of the people we spoke about today, or to our panelists' websites, be part of our Twitter, Facebook network, find out about our upcoming shows, or to make suggestions for future programs, please look at our website, www.actionspeaksradio.org. Next week, we'll be talking about the creation in 1971 of one of the most important restaurants in American history, Alice Waters Chez Panisse, and the movement to eat fresh, eat local, and eat organically. This interview, there is an interview, by the way, with Alice Waters on our webpage. I'm Mark Levitt, wishing you health, happiness, and as much surprise as you need, and a little more than you think you can handle. Thank you.